Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/brainstorm now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more brainstorming tools like private mode and voting. That's miro.com/brainstorm now.
Hi there. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of your journey today. I'm your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio. My special guest is Randy Liebeck, and he is a research specialist, field investigator, and journalist covering the field of ghost and poltergeist phenomena, utilizing a combination of cognitive skills and the latest in technological monitoring and detection equipment. He has conducted haunted house investigations throughout the United States and in Great Britain. He has had cases referred to him by individuals, universities, the news media, attorneys, government agencies, and various parapsychological research organizations. Randy has also served as the behind-the-scenes consultant and on-air ghost expert for several TV programs, including Unsolved Mysteries, Dead Famous, Ghostly Encounters, and Unexplained Mysteries. And now, here is my special guest, Randy Liebeck.
Well, I grew up as a child in the late 1960s reading spooky stories, reading Fate magazine, reading books about haunted houses and ghost encounters, and mainly fictional books. But as I grew older, my interest became, is there a underlying reality to these stories? Is it all made up or is there something really going on? And the more I read, the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there is something going on. Even with the fictional stories of literature, there were some original underlying human experiences that these fictional stories were based on. And that just fascinated me. And the interest continued as I grew up into adulthood. And eventually, I got to the point where I started doing field investigations into spontaneous cases.
So have you experienced anything like as a child, you know, have you lived in a haunted house or seen an entity or anything like that?
Not as a child. As a child, I do remember just a faint memory of being in my crib. And I remember I would rap on the bedroom wall with my knuckles between the slats of the crib. And I recall that I would get a response, and my mother would come into the room and say, what are you doing? Why are you knocking on the wall? I told her, I'm talking with the ghosts that live in the wall. And that's all I remember about it. And it's quite possible that because my room was adjacent to a dry cleaning shop. So it's quite possible that there's somebody in the dry cleaning shop knocking back at me. But I remember, as a very young child in the crib, I remember, I was talking to ghosts, at least in the way I interpreted that.
Yeah.
But beyond that, no encounters as a child. The encounter started as I became an adult and I started becoming active in this field and started looking for things.
Okay. So tell us about the first encounter.
First encounter, I've had numerous encounters which make me go and make me raise an eyebrow. But the first encounter that I was convinced was absolutely something out of the ordinary. I was in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, there to investigate the ghosts of the battlefield. And I didn't find anything on the battlefields. At the end of the night, one evening, I retired to my motel room. And as I was laying in bed, I started hearing a scratching in the wall behind my head, like scratching, then light tapping. And I thought, this is interesting. You know, are there rats inside the wall or something? But in the back of my mind, I also realized, hey, this is how 9 out of 10 poltergeist events begin, which intrigued me. So I was a two-bed room. I moved over to the other bed on the other side of the room, laid down. The scratching and tapping moved from location one to the second bed right behind my head. So I laid there for a while because I wanted to go to sleep. And the sound get louder and louder. It began sounding like somebody was snaking cables through the wall, which was a possibility that I considered. Then the sound left the wall. The sound of scratching, tapping, and loud pounding left the wall, was no longer emanating from a structural surface, but was in the open air surrounding me. And the sounds, again, rapping, scratching, pounding, like somebody pounding on something solid, were emanating from open air surrounding me from all directions. I had another person in the room with me who heard this too. This kept getting louder and louder. And in conjunction with the sounds, which were classic poltergeist type audio phenomena, in addition to the sounds, there was a sense of altered consciousness, an altered state of being. The sensation, it's called the Oz factor by other researchers, but it's a sense that you've left your normal reality. And now, you know, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. That you're enveloped by a sense of just absolute strangeness and almost unreality. However, I and my friend were completely awake, and it was just an eerie feeling. And this went on for at least a couple of hours. My friend got so scared, she left. She fled the hotel room, did not come back until very late that evening. And the sound was continuing, and I just fell asleep eventually. Which intrigues me. Normally, if I'm experiencing, you know, ghostly stuff, which is, you know, I've lived my entire life looking for, you know, if it's happening around me, you would think that I would not just fall asleep, but I did. And that intrigues me to this day. Was there something in the environment which induced me to fall asleep? Next morning, woke up, went back out in the battlefield, no experiences where I was looking for ghosts, come back to the same hotel room. Around the same time, it was around 8 p.m. at night, the exact same process started again, scratching and tapping directly behind my head inside the wall. I again moved to the other bed. It followed. I had my friend laying on the original bed. She no longer heard it there. It actually moved from location A to location B. Exact same pattern continued. The sounds left the wall, were then emanating from space directly around us. We could not determine the exact spot, but it was not coming from a wall, from the ceiling, or from the floor. We opened the door to the hallway of the hotel. I stepped out. No sounds. You could not hear the sound in the hallway, even though the sounds were loud enough to have been heard. My friend repeated that she experienced the same thing. She could not hear the sounds outside of the room. Next thought I had, okay, maybe, you know, there's something going on upstairs on the second floor and the sound is radiating through the structure of the hotel somehow. I went upstairs, found the room, which was, I assumed was directly over ours or very close to directly over ours. Heard no sound from that room. I could not tell if it was even occupied. Heard no people in there, and there were no sounds, no noises. Came back downstairs. The sound was continuing in my room, and my friend said the sound had continued the entire time I was upstairs. Again, it continued. This was around 8 o'clock. It continued around 11, 11:30. I just dozed off, as did my friend. We both just fell asleep, even though we were, you know, fascinated by what's going on around us. Next morning, we're checking out, and I go up to the front desk, and I say, hey, I'm in room so-and-so, I'm checking out. I have a question about the teller, the clerk stopped me, gave me a look that would chill anybody to their core, and said, we are not haunted. We do not have ghosts here. Thank you for staying. Please come again. That response intrigued me, and it still does to this day. I didn't mention anything about my experiences. I asked nothing. I said nothing about ghosts. She did not know who I was. I just say, I have a question to ask you, and we are not haunted. Thank you. Come again.
Wow.
And for anyone who's interested, it's the Comfort Inn on York Street in Gettysburg.
They probably know they're haunted. They know that. That's why they said it. That's funny.
Yep. And I've done some research since then, and I can't find any records. There's nothing on the internet, nothing in any books I have specifying that hotel is haunted. However, that hotel was built in the 1950s. And the plot of land it was built on top of, there was a battle during the Battle of Gettysburg.
Well, see, I was going to say that it's probably built on something that's, you know, where something happened. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, you know, while you were there, did you talk to any other people that were staying, see if they experienced anything?
No, I didn't. And that's not the only unusual part about this, that I did not talk to anybody else. And the fact that I fell asleep both nights earlier than I would normally have fallen asleep. It felt like I and my friend were getting this like very, very tired, very sleepy, and we could not stay awake. What's also intriguing is that I was there in Gettysburg to do ghost investigations. I had tape recorders, I had video cameras, I had still cameras, I had infrared equipment, magnetic field detectors. While all of this was going on two nights, neither I nor my friend, who was also helping me with the ghost investigations, never once did the thought cross our mind, hey, let's pull out a tape recorder and see if we can record these sounds that we're hearing. We never pulled out the equipment out of the suitcases, out of the Pelican cases, never pulled out an EM field reader to see if there are any distortions in the local energetic fields. That I did not think of that, and that she did not think of that, astounds me to this day. It wasn't until we were driving home from Pennsylvania back to New Jersey, we're in the car, and almost simultaneously we looked at each other and said, we're idiots. We're there for two nights in the middle of an audio poltergeist outbreak with all kinds of equipment, and we did not even think about opening up the case and turning anything on. Now that I've had a lot of time to think about this, this was back in the early 90s. Now that I've thought about it, I strongly suspect that the same effect that made us fall asleep both nights and just doze off, even though we were fascinated by what was going on, I think that there was some sort of field, some sort of energy there, which was intentionally and actively keeping us from thinking about, hey, let's document this. Let's get some evidence that this is really happening. And it wasn't until we left the area that that thought process came to us as it should have, you know, the first night we were there.
Yeah. Let me ask you something, because your background to me is intriguing, because you have a career, or had a career. I don't know if you're retired. Are you retired from the law enforcement? Are you still doing that or not?
Not retired. I moved from police work to national security work with the federal government.
Got you. Okay. So doing that, I mean, do your coworkers know that you're into this stuff?
Oh, yes, they do. I'm known as the resident ghost hunter.
Well, I mean, what kind of responses have you been getting from them? Are they receptive of it, or are you been getting some laughs and teasing, or what?
I've been getting laughs and teasing my entire career of being a cop. It has nothing to do with my ghost hunting activities.
Gotcha.
But yes, a lot of the guys have been very interested. I've brought my fellow cops out on casework with me. We've done investigations with several guys from my old departments. I've also been invited by officers from other police departments to tag along with them when they've gone out on calls, or they're aware of a local allegedly haunted spot in their town or their patrol zone. Police chief of Newark, New Jersey, brought me out to a haunted cemetery in Newark that he and his guys had experienced things at before.
What did he say happened? Can you tell us what they say happened?
Yeah, I don't remember all the details. It was nothing that really impressed me at the time. Probably a lady in white seen walking between the gravestones at night. However, also in that graveyard in downtown Newark, New Jersey, there were homeless people in night. There were drug addicts who would hang out and hide behind the tombstones. So reports just on the surface of it, of people being seen walking around at night, doesn't strike me as that evidential. However, from his standpoint, the chief's standpoint, and the guys under him, they seemed to think it was something unusual. So we went out there, checked it out, did not stay till it was dark, though. So I could not experience what he said he'd experienced.
Okay. Now, I know that cops do experience things. You know, I've come across several books where, you know, people have written about just paranormal activity experienced by law enforcement. So have you, you know, is that something that you've looked into, you know, during your investigations? I mean, have you asked them about their experiences, or have you yourself on duty experienced something weird or strange?
I have never experienced anything potentially paranormal while on duty. I've never responded to a call myself. However, I do know and have talked to lots of other cops who have. I had reached out once. I put a notice in the Police Union magazine that we have for cops in New Jersey. And I said, hey, you know, I'm Randy. I work at this department. I'm interested in this kind of stuff. And if any of you guys, you know, active duty or retired, have ever responded to a call where you think something possibly paranormal was happening, or if you got called to a haunted house or a poltergeist, I got so many responses. I have a large Tupperware container full of letters and printouts of emails I got from around the country, not just New Jersey, of people telling me some of the stories were, you know, they had responded to a call, or, you know, people thought they had a ghost or had a poltergeist. And the cops, you know, that's not within their purview of expertise. So they would respond to the call, but say, hey, you know, lady, I can't really help you. And they said, you know, if Randy, if we'd known you, we would have given you a shout. But most of the reports I got from other cops around the country were of the places they worked at, haunted jails, haunted prisons, haunted police precincts, and also haunted hospitals, when cops would respond, you know, to an assault or a shooting, and they had to go to the hospital to follow up on it, and the experiences they would have in the emergency room or going down to the morgue to see a body.
Oh, goodness. Wait. Now, that's interesting right there. Can you recall any of it? Can you tell us about some of that stuff? I mean, that's juicy stuff. Tell us about that.
I'd have to pull up my notes for specific details and years and locations. But offhand, there were a couple of instances where police officers had to go to the morgue where a body had come in or somebody had died related to a crime, a shooting or a stabbing. The body is then wheeled down to the morgue. The cops had to respond, take a report, had to inspect the body. And a couple of cases, they were left alone in the morgue for a few minutes, and they reported seeing moving shadows or feeling a sensation. One guy told me he turned around and was writing in his little notepad, and he felt a hand on his shoulder. And he turned around and freaked out and left the hospital. These type of reports are not uncommon, and I was actually surprised. And I knew they wouldn't be uncommon because I know, like you do, that police experience stuff. I've talked to so many guys, even local to where I've worked. But I knew it, you know, happened, but I did not know I would get this many reports from around the country. So it is relatively common, but the average person doesn't hear about it because, for the most part, cops do not discuss this kind of stuff outside, you know, the police community, you know, not for public consumption.
Got you, got you. All right, let's talk about some of your investigations. Tell us about something that you're currently working on right now, you know, if you can. Something that's, you know, pretty active. Can you tell us about something like that?
Currently, right now, absolutely nothing. Thank you, Mr. COVID. It's in New Jersey. It's not been safe to leave the house for the past year, pretty much.
Got you. Okay.
Yep.
What about something else? Tell us about something in the past that you've worked on that was active.
Well, one interesting case I had was in Dutchess County, New York. I had gotten case referred to me, I think, by Lloyd Auerbach, who's a parapsychologist in California. And a woman from Dutchess County called me up and said she was experiencing poltergeist activity. While I was talking with her on the phone, and she was telling me her experiences, and I was trying to determine whether or not it was, you know, anything I was interested in and worth me following up on, she was telling me, you know, things that would happen that would scare her and scare her children. I started giving her advice. I say, well, you know, some things we found that work in these cases, if you have a ghost or you think you do, you know, tell it, you know, don't scare my children. Or if you're going to bang closet doors around, don't do it after 9 o'clock when the kids are trying to sleep. Every time I would give her a specific piece of advice intended to help her mitigate or calm down what she was experiencing, a loud roaring static would come over the phone line. To prevent me from saying what I was saying. And on my end, I could hear this loud roaring static. If I would discuss other things with her, or she was just telling me what was going on, or if I was just, you know, discussing some things which did not involve things she could do to mitigate the circumstances, it was fine. Once I said, well, try this, or you might want to, you know, try that. Loud roaring, incredibly loud, you know, electronic static noise, which I thought was interesting. It seemed to be targeted to the content of what I was saying. On her end, she didn't hear loud static. She heard a gruff male voice that she said she knew was not my voice, cursing, using extreme profanity, telling her she was going to die, her kids were going to die. And it was at the same time I heard the static coming on. So after that initial phone call, I was interested. I wanted to, you know, at least go out there and talk to her in person and see the house she was in. So a couple of days later, I get into my car. The car had no mechanical problems whatsoever, had always been running fine. I'm driving to Dutchess County. About halfway there, or a little bit less than halfway there, I started experiencing the engine starts dying. The car is sputtering. The accelerator goes down, but the car does not accelerate. So something's wrong. I pull over, decide I cannot, you know, continue on to New York. You know, I'll get stuck. I turn around. As soon as I turn around and I'm heading back in the other direction, car is working fine. So I'm driving for about 20 minutes. Car is fine. It's okay. I don't know what that was, but it seems to have been, you know, a one-time glitch. So I turn back around, heading back to New York. Almost as soon as I do that, same thing. Car starts sputtering, stalling. I pull off to the side of the road. I say, okay, you know, that's it. You know, something's wrong with the car. I'm not going to get stranded. Turn around, head back home. Car runs fine all the way home. And had no problem with the car since. It seemed to me, and I still think to this day, that something knew I was going out to that location and something was trying to keep me for getting out there. I did eventually get out to the case. I worked the case for 2 years. While I was there, I and other researchers who were with me, we witnessed a few things. We saw a light fixture that would swing around, stop, and start swinging again, not being caused by any vibration, not being caused by anybody walking around. We observed a children's toy car moving around on its own. We saw a picture, a framed painting on the wall start rotating left and right, then left again. And again, we could detect no vibration. There were no trucks going down the road that it could have done that. We could not duplicate it when we stomped around and pounded on the walls. So not major kind of stuff that you would see in a horror movie. But it was enough stuff that I'm convinced that there was a paranormal activity going on. She was convinced it was a ghost or some sort of entity that was coming to torment her. And it was not just her. It was four houses on the same street. All of her neighbors experienced stuff too. But these were all houses that she would visit and she would hang out at occasionally. I'm convinced that she was causing this subconsciously through subconscious psychokinesis, which is the model that we think in most cases explains what a poltergeist is. It's not a ghost, it's a person and their own innate psychic and psychokinetic abilities.
Yeah.
So that casework lasted 2 years. And then finally she got tired of dealing with it, and her and one of her neighbors around the same time just moved away.
Let me ask you something with her before you go on real quick, because you bring up a good point. Some people think that only spaces are haunted. Right. Have you actually explored that possibility with her to see if maybe she picked up an attachment or something like that?
Well, in this case, the neighborhood itself had a reputation going back to at least the 1930s. Possibly earlier, of it being haunted by the ghost of a little girl who had been wandering around the neighborhood, appearing to be lost and crying for her mother. I found one of the neighbors who was in her late 80s, early 90s, who remembered when she was a little girl in that neighborhood, knowing about the ghost of a little girl. So it was a haunted neighborhood, but what my client was experiencing was different. It was physical. Objects were moving. Her kitchen cabinets were opening and closing. Glassware and dishes were exploding on her kitchen table. TV and radio channels would change by themselves. The baby's crib slats would be let down, endangering the safety of the baby. The mother would put the slats back up and they'd be found down again. That's something the baby itself could not have done. So it was a physical activity, and it focused on this one woman or places that she would visit and hang out at. So the activity, the physical activity, what we would classify as poltergeist activity as opposed to haunting, was just on observation, was focused on her. It happened when she was around. It happened at other locations when she went to those other locations or shortly after she had visited. So something was connected with her. Now, the question is this possibly some sort of external entity, a ghost or a spirit, which was latched onto her and was following her or was hanging out where she was? That is one way to look at this. The other way to look at it is that there are certain people who, through their unique neurology, their unique psychological processes, and in particular, certain stress factors people can be going through. And there may be hormonal and chemical aspects to that too. But there is a signature poltergeist agent profile. When we hear about these kind of cases, we look for specific signatures that we expect the percipients to have. And in her case, she met this profile completely. She was going through a stress-filled divorce at the time. She was having a difficulty with her ex-husband legally. There were issues with the child custody going on. She was involved in another relationship, which was causing some stress. So those stress dynamics were there. So I feel, and I brought a psychologist in with me to interview her also, and we both concurred that she fits the profile, especially the psychological stress factors, which can generate, we think, sometimes a poltergeist agent. That sometimes, instead of most of us, when we have extreme stress or trauma that we have to deal with, we vent it somehow. You know, we'll get into a fight, we'll yell, we'll cry. You know, maybe we'll, you know, pound on a wall or throw a dish against the wall. Some people don't do that externally for whatever reason. You know, they keep it all bottled inside. Well, that stress, that emotional energy has to get out somehow, or it's going to cause possibly permanent physical and psychological damage. So it looks like in some of these cases that pent up stress is somehow exteriorized. It's pushed out into the environment where it affects things. Maybe the person does not physically pick up a dish and throw it against the wall, but guess what? The dish lifts up off the table, flies across the room, and hits the wall. And we think that's what was happening in this case with this, you know, primary percipient. And it also seemed that whatever was going on with her neurologically and psychologically and chemically that might have allowed this had a contagious aspect to it, a viral contagion, because when she would visit other people's houses, similar things would happen during her visit there or immediately afterwards. She did not have to be physically present as long as she had been at the location. So some sort of poltergeist residue seemed to be left behind. Gotcha. And yeah, we could say maybe it's a ghost, maybe it's some kind of spirit that latched on to her. But the fact that, you know, some sort of residue was left at other locations when she wasn't there, it's hard to tell. I mean, I'm open to the idea of some poltergeist cases being an external entity. You know, maybe it is dear dead Aunt Edna coming back. But why would dear dead Aunt Edna, you know, mess with the baby, you know, make glasses and dishes explode, keep changing the channels on the radio? This seemed to be psychological in nature, and it seemed to be through some process we don't understand.
Let me ask you this real quick, because, you know, poltergeist phenomena is normally connected with very young children, before they reach, before they're teenagers, usually. I'm assuming this is a grown adult woman that you're talking about.
Grown adult woman, okay, in gotcha. Her 30s. Uh-huh. It is an outlier case. You are right. Most of the cases in the literature are adolescents. And we think there may be some connection with the hormonal and chemical changes involved with going through puberty, and the fact that a lot of, you know, adolescents are going through, you know, a lot of emotional turmoil.
So the phenomenon that you're talking about sounds just incredible. Were you able to get any of that on video?
We were able to record the hanging fixture, which I misspoke. It was not a light fixture. It was a hanging metal incense burner, very heavy, hanging from a chain from the ceiling. And we recorded that moving in one direction with the arc, the width of the arc and the speed increasing. Then it would come to a stop and then it would start again. And again, the width of the arc increasing, which indicates that the energy being expended is increasing, rather than, you know, dying out. If you had pushed it and spun it around with your hand, as it if that was the case, as it spins, the arc is going to shrink and the speed of spinning is going to slow down as it naturally, you know, comes to the end of its energy expenditure. This was worked in the opposite direction, which we could not explain. And we also filmed a toy car where the wheels would spin. She had called me at 3 o'clock in the morning, I think, one day, screaming that her child's toy car was chasing her around the house when she was in the house alone. Now, it was a remote-controlled, battery-powered toy. So, of course, the first assumption is, okay, somebody has, you know, a remote control and is controlling the car. But she had both the remote controls. When I got there the next day with another two other investigators, we took the car. We took both the remote controls. There was no one else in the house but us and the principal. Windows and blinds were closed, so nobody could look and see what was going on. And the car, when we put it down, it would start moving. The motor would come on. It would start following her wherever she went. We put the car upside down on the kitchen table so that it wouldn't roll off the table. And we were discussing what was going on, and we were filming this entire incident. And she was explaining what had happened the night before, and the car was chasing her. And every time she would talk and gesture towards the car with her hand while speaking, the car would energize, the motor would start, and then when she would move her hand back, the car would de-energize, power down. Her hand was at no time ever closer than 2 feet from the car. The car seemed to know when she was gesturing towards it. The car also, the wheels would go left and right because you could steer it through remote control. So I, as an experiment, I said, Julie, tell the car to turn left. She said, turn left. The wheels turned left. Julie, tell the car to turn right. She'd say, car turn right. The wheels would cut right. At that point, we were convinced that there had to be somebody hiding in the house with another remote control doing this, because it's in a response to her gestures and what she said. There was no one else in the house. We made sure that nobody could be outside the house looking through the window to see us, to see her gestures or to hear what she was saying. And each time that she did this, made a motion towards the car or talked to the car, and the car would power up. Well, we had equipment throughout the house monitoring the environment. There was a burst of negative ions that would generate immediately before each of these events. It was like 1 second to a half second before she would say, car, move, go left, go right, or gesture towards it. My colleague in the other room with the detection equipment had a negative ion detector. He would call out, hey, we're getting a burst. And that's when she would be gesturing and the car would move. So again, that seems to me to be psychokinesis. And that that plays into the haunted person aspect, subconsciously causing it. I don't really think there was a ghost there.
People experience, you know, like the stone phenomena. You know, those stones mm-hmm. will be thrown at them, or stones will come through the ceiling, or, you know, coins or something like something weird like that. I mean, did anything like that happen?
No. And what you're describing is the difference between a class one and a class two poltergeist. The class one poltergeist, and this is a scale that a researcher named D. Scott Rogo came up with back in the 70s or 80s. Class one poltergeists seem to be mainly kinetic. Things move, a glass may shatter, doors open and close, it can be loud pounding noises. These are your classic, typical poltergeist cases, which we think can be explained very simply by a person somehow generating some sort of unknown energy from themselves into the environment, which in this case, we seem to a degree confirm that, because our negative ion readings seem to correlate with these activities. But there's also a class two poltergeist. Class two poltergeists involve stranger things. Class two can involve stones falling from nowhere. Not just stones, we can have coins or other small objects materializing in midair in someone's house and falling to the ground. Can include spontaneous fires breaking out, puddles of water appearing from nowhere. It can involve people being bit, scratched, punched. And in this case, the main antagonist here, Julie, she had called me once. She was at a Barnes & Noble bookstore. And while she was talking to me, I heard oomph, and I heard a big thud and the sounds of books falling down. And she said that when she was talking to me on the phone, something had pushed her, had knocked her over, and she fell into a shelf of books and knocked them down. Now, I was not there to witness that, so I'm taking it at face value based on what she said and what I heard. But that that seemed to straddle the type one, you know, type two, where people start getting assaulted in these cases. So type two cases, there are aspects of that which seem to indicate maybe some external intelligence involved, that maybe that's not just the living poltergeist agent who's behind it. But for the most part, this case was type one. Almost everything that she reported and everything that I encountered to varying degrees while I was there indicated type one, indicated that this was something that she was generating somehow.
Have you actually investigated any of the more popular locations that are known to be haunted? And if so, what kind of experiences did you have there?
For the most part, I respond to case referrals that I get from research institutes or from the news media or from somebody contacting me privately and saying, hey, you know, they have events in their house. So I'm not one of these folks, for the most part, who goes out to public locations and museums and haunted abandoned asylums and stuff. The two exceptions to that, I have a fascination with the Gettysburg battlefield, mainly because it's relatively close to me. And I believe through literature review and through my own experiences there that acre for acre, square foot by square foot, Gettysburg is one of the most haunted spots of ground in the United States. Not so much poltergeist activity, even though that event I had in the hotel was definitely an audible poltergeist scenario. But for the most part, it seems to be what we call a place memory, a haunting, where all the trauma, death, pain caused by those 3 days of battle in the 1800s seem to have impregnated the atmosphere or even the time-space fabric in that location with memories or echoes of these events. And I've experienced stuff along those lines every time I've been there. I have seen things, I have heard things, I have felt things. So Gettysburg is one of my favorite publicly accessible haunted locations. The other place I've been to, which was interesting, I've been to New Orleans several times. And New Orleans has a reputation for being haunted. I did not really experience anything there myself, except in New Orleans, there's a weird feeling of density to the atmosphere that some people would describe, hey, that's a signature of something, you know, paranormal in the air, possibly, or it could just be a signature of the fact that you're several feet below sea level and maybe the atmospheric pressure is a little bit different than we're used to. But one trip I went on a ghost tour, a walking ghost tour that all the tourists go on. And I was waiting for the tour to start and I was standing outside one of the local voodoo shops. And I think it might've been called Doc Zombie's Voodoo Shop. While I was waiting there, some guy came walking out of the shop. And the guy looked like somebody who you would find in a place called Doc Zombie's Voodoo Shop. He might have been a practitioner of voodoo or century or something. He was dressed appropriately. He handed me a set of cheap white plastic beads, you know, New Orleans Mardi Gras beads that, you know, they throw to all the girls down there. He said, "You need these." You know, "Why do I need these?" He goes, "That's for your protection. They know you're here. And they are going to follow you." And they gave me the beads. Went back inside the shop. I said, "Okay, cool, whatever." I got me a free set of, you know, 75-cent plastic beads. What the heck? So did the tour. Went back home the next day or the day after. Didn't think anything about it. I had brought all of my ghost hunting equipment with me, and it returned home with me. When I got home, I unpacked my bags. Took all of my ghost gear out, my Geiger counters, my magnetometers, my video cameras, et cetera, took them out of the case, made sure they were turned off, you know, so I don't waste the batteries, left them on the floor beside the bed, went to work the next day at the police department, came back home from work. I walk into my bedroom to the sounds of beep, 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 and lights flashing. All the equipment was turned on and running. So I thought, okay, That's weird. I really thought I turned the stuff off, and it should have been off anyway, even in the suitcase. I must have had a brain fart. So I made it a point to turn all this stuff off so I don't waste the batteries. Left everything on the floor, though, because I'm very slow when it comes to unpacking and reorganizing stuff after a trip. Went to work the next day, came back home at the end of the day, walk into my bedroom to flashing lights and things going beep, 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 beep. All the equipment was back on and running. I lived alone. Nobody had broken into my apartment. And at that point, I remembered because the beads were laying on the nightstand beside the bed, these white plastic beads that this Doc Zombie or one of his denizens told me, "Hey, you need these because something knows you're here and is going to follow you." On surface analysis, it looks like something followed me back from New Orleans. And was making his presence known for 2 days. After the second time, it didn't happen. And believe me, the third day, I came home from work half expecting to find everything back on again. But no, everything was still turned off.
Wow. Now, New Orleans is a place that I hope to go someday. maybe this year, I don't know. But yeah, I will definitely look into all those haunted locations. And Randy, before we go, please take a moment to tell my listeners where they can find out more information about you or anything else you're working on.
I would recommend that listeners go to my website, which is ghosthunter.iwarp.com. That's ghosthunter.iwarp.com. That has, you can also link to my Facebook page through there if you want to follow me on Facebook. And the page has, the website has some of the investigations I've done, some articles I've written, some clips of TV shows I've done. And it has a lot of information, a lot of the concepts we've been discussing about poltergeist and psychokinesis. I have a glossary on there which explains what these terms mean and what my experiences with them have been and what my thoughts are on these subjects.
All right, Randy, many blessings to you, and I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.